Welcome back to Question Mess in 2017. It has been long, way too long, way too long. But sometimes it's just right. And that is what this episode is all about. This episode is about exercise. Exercise, not too much, not too little, but just right. It's called Goldilocks in the Three Different Exercise Time Lengths. Not too much, not too little, but just right. Here we go. Let's kick it off. Exercise and Goldilocks. All right, welcome back. Here we go. I am Andrew Bilt, and I am still down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And yes, oh yes, I know it has been far, far too long since I've last put out an episode. I will try to get back on the horse, try to get back on the saddle and ride, if you will. It has just been kind of hectic, kind of crazy, kind of too much, to be honest. So I apologize, and I will get back on that. They may be shorter than this one, but let's dig into it just a little bit. This is talking about exercise. Exercise, what's good, what's bad, what's just right. And so I think there's one thing we can all say before we get going, and that is exercise is good. The more you move, the better. We know that in multiple studies now, exercise has been shown with a greater association for reduced heart disease and cancer. And while we can't say this is truly causation because we just don't have the randomized controlled trials that are long enough to really show that, we can say this has been shown over and over again, and it pretty much appears that that association is there. So this isn't new information, though. We've known this ever since Dr. Morris back in the 1950s did the UK bus study, where he found that the bus drivers had a higher increased rate of heart attacks and early death compared to the conductors that were walking up and down the trains getting the tickets. We've known exercise is good, sitting is bad. In fact, I think we could say exercise is awesome. But if you've ever heard this podcast before, then you know there is no good without bad. There is no great without evil. There is no up without down. There is never a number needed to treat without a number needed to harm. And I'm sure some of you have seen some of the recent articles, some of the recent headlines in the paper, if you will, and they say, is running bad for you? Marathons temporarily damage kidneys in runners' bodies, study finds. Or what about this one? Marathons are bad for your health, scientists warn runners. Or how much running is bad for your heart? Or my personal favorite, endurance training is bad for your heart. Again, nothing is the number needed to treat of one. Nothing is the number needed to harm of one. So let's look at the details a little closer. Let's figure out how much exercise is too much, how much is too little, and how much is just right. Now, before we get into studies, I think we got to do something first. And that is, we got to look at the problems with the evidence. The evidence around exercise. The evidence, well, it's pretty much the evidence around exercise. Number one is you can't do a long randomized controlled trial. And here's the reason why. This is the same reason that we'll never have good evidence for things like coffee consumption and what it does for your health, is because those individuals who love to exercise or even semi-enjoy exercising will never join a long-term study, or if they do, they're going to drop out, in which they could be blinded or randomized to the group that doesn't exercise. You're just not going to do it. You're not going to join a trial that says, hey, I know you love your 3 cups of Starbucks every day, but, or Dunkin' Donuts, not to be biased or anything, but you are now in the study and you can no longer ever drink coffee. It's just not going to happen. So number two, you can't blind the study, at least not double blind, because the people know whether they're exercising. That's the crazy thing. They know whether they're sitting on their couch or they're up on the treadmill. You can't blind that. Number three, people drastically overestimate time and energy in observational data. And I think we know this. I mean, you look around, maybe you're even a little guilty of this yourself, but somebody says, hey, how long are you at the gym at? How long were you at the gym for? And you say, oh, I was there about an hour. You're rounding up from 31 minutes. And we all know it, and we've all done it. I'm also guilty as charged, and I get it. But that's another problem with exercise trials. And then it's often surrogate marker based. It's based off glucose tolerance test, A1Cs, muscle biopsies, looking at ATP and mitochondrial synthesis. It's based on LDLs and total cholesterol. It's based on all these things that we think are good, we want to believe are good, but we don't really know if they are good because they are not the hard patient outcomes like mortality. And then finally, it's hard to put a lot of these studies into practice. A lot of these studies come with a personal trainer or someone who's going to call you 24/7 or someone who's going to show up at your house or someone who's going to pick you up at your house, take you there, have you do it, and then drive you home. It comes with a lot of excess that we really just don't have. We don't have in the community. We don't have when you're seeing the patient in front of you, and we don't have when you are the patient. It's just not feasible. So let's start off again, Goldilocks. How much is too much? How much is too little? And how much is just right? First study we're going to look at, BMJ 1998. Lone atrial fibrillation in vigorously exercising middle-aged men. This is a case-control study. They looked at AFib rates in 60 of the top-ranked orienteers versus almost 500 men from an earlier study. Now, that earlier study was the prevalence of diabetes, hypertension, and ischemic heart disease in former athletes, and all of those individuals completed military physicals at age 18. So it's not like these were unhealthy people that they're comparing them to. They compare him, orienteers, if you don't know what that is, it's this crazy thing. You got to look on YouTube. Heads down, running, trying to follow a map, a compass. It's in the woods. It's over trees. It's in a mountain. I mean, it is, it's pretty wild. Pretty crazy indeed. Anyways, they looked at the study, and here's what they found. That if you were in the orienteers group, so the top of the, I mean, the top 60 in the world in their sport of running up and down around mountains using a compass, your overall mortality was about 2% compared to 8.5% in the general public or these healthy match controls. What about coronary heart disease? 2.7 versus 7.5%. That's pretty good. Both of those are around number needs to treat of 20 to 30. We'll say 25. But then the orienteers, the top orienteers, they had AFib at 5.3% compared to less than 1% in the general public. That is a number needed to harm of almost 25 for AFib. And so I said that I saw this paper and I said, well, this is it. This is the answer. This is the answer to Goldilocks' question of how much is too much. However much they're doing is a little too much, because although the mortality is low and the coronary heart disease is low, the AFib is up. And we know AFib, while some may call it a surrogate marker, it's not necessarily the hard endpoint we're looking for. It is definitely an endpoint that I don't want. So I emailed the authors and they responded. They said, thank you for your interest in our paper. We have no accurate information of training amounts or the age of starting of the orienteering group. However, the study population consisted of the top-ranked individuals in their age group, and orienteers usually start their sport at quite an early age, end quote. So, not as helpful as I was hoping it was going to be, but let's look a little further. What is too much? When is too much to get AFib, to get these bad things that you read about in the news? Circulation 2011, this one, cardiac arrhythmogenic remodeling in a rat model. And here's what they did. They took these rats, put them on a treadmill, ran them for 16 weeks, and compared them to a control that didn't exercise at all. Now, they say that rats' lifespan is about 2 to 2.5 years, and they're making them run for 60 minutes at 60 centimeters per second. That's right, centimeters per second. They are rats, after all. And they thought that was about equivalent to 10 years of human exercising at 90% of predicted heart rate. Not bad. 60 minutes, 10 years, 90% of your heart rate. That's really booking it. If you're, you know, if you've ever worked out 90% of your heart rate, imagine doing that for 10 years of your life. That's pretty significant. Afterwards, they did some euthanasia. They did serial echocardiograms during the study. They looked at, took a biopsy of the heart and looked at ventricle collagen deposition, did some staining. And here's what they found. At 16 weeks, the rats developed eccentric left ventricular hypertrophy, some diastolic dysfunction, and some diffuse fibrosis in the atria and right ventricle. Now, they weren't looking for AFib, but that's what they found. However, if you've ever heard this podcast before, you've ever heard anything I've ever said before about animal studies, the answer is I'm not a veterinarian. I don't take care of animals. So while they're interesting, they're fun, they're fascinating, I don't take care of animals. So I don't know how necessarily helpful that is, but I did find it fascinating, to say the least. So let's move on. Here we go. On to the next one. Eurospace 2009. Is the risk of AFib higher in athletes and in the general public? In the general population, excuse me. This was a meta-analysis. This looked at six case control studies published in peer-reviewed journals. There was about 650 athletes compared to about 900 controls. And they looked at AFib in the athletes. And here you go. You ready? 23% of AFib in athletes, only 12.5% of those in the general population. You're following along at home. That's a number needed to harm of around 10. The overall risk of AFib was significantly higher in athletes than in controls, with an odds ratio of 5.29. I know that's just a point estimate, but another way to say that would be your odds ratio, your odds is 429 times greater of developing AFib if you're an athlete than compared to if you're a non-athlete. That is pretty significant. Here we go. Moving on. Keeping up with the pace. I don't want to make this drag on for too long. So we know athletes have a high risk of AFib. In fact, it's really high. It's much higher than I ever thought before I started doing this research, which leads to the next study. They took Swedish participants that participated in the 56-mile Vasaloppet cross-country skiing event. And from what I have read online, it is a long-distance cross-country skiing race. It's held on the first Sunday in March. It is one of the longest and oldest cross-country skiing races in the world, as well as one of the highest number of participants. It's 56 miles. I mean, big. Go online and look this up. Vasaloppet. You look that up online, and there are just thousands of cross-country skiers trying to do this race, and it's a big deal, apparently. I don't cross-country ski, but they say it's a big deal. Their primary outcome was hospitalization for any arrhythmia, and their secondary outcome was atrial fibrillation or flutter. So here we go. Primary outcome, again, any arrhythmia with all the individuals. Again, as you can tell in the title of it, risk of arrhythmias in 52,755 long-distance cross-country skiers. So over 50,000 cross-country skiers, there was only 919 cases of arrhythmia were reported. That's a number needed to harm of about 55. But here's where I think it starts to get a little interesting. You had a higher incidence of arrhythmias with the increasing number of races you did. So if you did one race in the 10-year follow-up, then you had a little bit higher of a risk. If you did two races, you had more of a risk for arrhythmia than if you only did one. If you had three, you had more of a risk than if you did two or three, and so on. Also, the faster you finished, the more likely you were to have an arrhythmia. So if you were within 100 to 160% of the time that the leader finished the race, you had an increased risk of arrhythmia at almost the exact same percent or exact same risk. Fascinating. That's for any arrhythmia, but let's go on to the one that I think most of us care about, because this is mostly the ones that we're talking about when we're talking about exercise-induced arrhythmias, and that is atrial fibrillation. Now remember, there was only 919 cases of arrhythmia, but the secondary outcome of atrial fibrillation, 681 cases. So an overwhelming majority of the arrhythmia cases are atrial fibrillation. In fact, 681 atrial fibrillation, that's about a number needed to harm of 769. Now, there was a higher incidence of atrial fibrillation with higher number of races completed. Again, if you completed one, you were at increased risk, but if you completed two, you were even a greater risk, and three, even a greater risk, and four, a greater risk. But there was no difference, no statistical difference anyways, when you looked at the time compared to the winner, which would seem to suggest that atrial fibrillation from exercise, too much exercise, you will, is not necessarily a time-dependent variable, but it's more of a total endurance hours and not necessarily, again, pace-dependent, just total, complete hours of endurance. So in summary, so far, if you're a world-class or top-class athlete, the more exercise over time puts you at higher risk for an arrhythmia, but that risk is still very small, with roughly a number needed to harm of around 550 to 750, so we'll just split the difference at 650 over 20 years. But again, what we think is endurance hours. So what are the hours? That's what I want to lock down. What are the hours necessarily needed to put you at this increased risk? And here we go, the 2014 Heart Rhythm Society session in San Francisco. This was put as an abstract, as a poster, and I cannot find this study anywhere. Trust me, I have searched high and low. I have emailed authors. I've looked. I can't find it. I can't get it. I don't know if it's available right now. But what they did was they took 115 cases of athletes with AFib and then used regression analysis to match them with 57 age-matched control subjects. And they looked at what was the odds ratio for different things to get AFib. What was the odds ratio for AFib? Odds ratio for height, 1.06, meaning you were at greater risk to get AFib if you were a taller individual. Bad luck. The odds ratio for obstructive sleep apnea, 5.04. Again, I think this bears to be what we see in population. If you have obstructive sleep apnea, you are significantly at increased risk to develop atrial fibrillation. The odds ratio for sedentary individuals, 3.85. Again, this bears true with what we see. 3.85, if you are sedentary, those seem to be the individuals who are more likely to get AFib. And then the odds ratio, here we go, for heavy sport activity, greater than 2,000 hours of cumulative endurance activity, 4.52. So yes, the total endurance hours, total activity hours of greater than 2,000 hours puts you at almost the exact same risk as if you had sleep apnea. And they have a nice little J curve that kind of shows that. And this kind of bears true in what we see in other research, but they just did a great job of showing it on their graphs. However, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, observational data on this stuff is not great because everyone always overestimates. So what's the real number? I don't know if we'll ever know, but somewhere between 1,500 to 2,000 total endurance hours is where you reach that threshold of badness. Now warning, here we go. Sound the alarms. What I'm about to say is probably the worst evidence that is out there. In fact, I almost cut it out of this podcast because it's just bad. It's expert opinion, but it's such good expert opinion, I just have to go ahead and quote it. And this is John Mandrola, cardiac electrophysiologist practicing in Louisville, Kentucky. He is on Twitter. He writes for theheart.org. He writes for Medscape. If you have ever read anything about the heart, I'm sure you've read something that he has written. And he quotes, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it, in discussing AFib, but merely prescribing said treatments ignores the inflamed elephant in the room. There is no medical or surgical fix for inflammation overload. I mean inflammation from never taking your foot off the gas physically, mentally, or emotionally. For athletes with AFib, the issue is years of overinflammation from exercise and inadequate rest. For the obese and hypertensive patient, it's the inflammation of atrial stretch and fibrosis. For the executive and engineer, it's the inflammation of never having enough or never being exactly correct enough. Or maybe it's the three glasses and not one glass of wine, end quote. Again, quite interesting, because this kind of seems to be what we see, or what I'm seeing. In starting this whole lecture, and starting this whole deep dig, I thought the patient that got AFib was the Honda. And then I'm not talking about the car, I'm talking about the hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic. That's the patient that gets AFib, not the person that's out running 8 miles. But maybe he's on to something. Maybe AFib is really never taking your foot off the gas physically, mentally, or emotionally. It's too much stress for too long a time, and the heart goes into AFib, just maybe. Now, this sounds kind of all bad, but it's not all doom and gloom. No, not at all. In fact, The mortality of French participants in the Tour de France. This was published in the European Heart Journal back in 2017. Here's what they did. They looked at individuals who had French cyclists, if you will, actually. They completed the Tour de France, compared them with the French general public, and wouldn't you know it, during the time frame, 41% lower mortality. That's pretty significant. That's an endpoint I can get on. This did not look at the rates of AFib, but if they did, I'm sure it was probably higher among those, or at least equal among those that were in the Tour de France. However, lower mortality. So again, we know how much now is too much, around 2,000 hours total endurance training. We don't know how much is too little. So let's go into it. The American Heart Association, their recommendations for exercise, and I'm just going to quote right from their website, says 30 minutes a day, five times a week is an easy goal to remember. If you can't remember that, they have this wonderful, confusing slide on their website that says at least 30 minutes of moderate exercise at least 5 days a week, or you can do at least 25 minutes at least 3 days a week for a total of 75 minutes, or then also do high intensity exercise. So, you know, it's a terrible chart. Let's just talk about exercise. How much do you really need? First things first, you don't exercise to lose weight. No, you can't exercise to lose weight. When you look at the trials on exercising and losing weight, typically speaking, individuals lose weight in whether it's 6 months or 12 months. If they're only doing exercise, they lose about 3 pounds. And the interesting thing is, if you go through a 12-month trial, they don't necessarily lose more than 3 pounds. It's about 3 or 4 pounds no matter the length of the trial. So you don't necessarily do exercise for weight loss. And the reason that is because the total energy expenditure of the body is not additive. You don't work out more and then you build more and, you know, lose more energy, kill calories and kilojoules. No, it's at some point you reach a threshold where the rest of your body starts to conserve while you're doing physical activity. So while you're still burning more than you would have if you were just sitting on the couch, you're not building the unlimited infinity amount that we all might wish that we were. But there is such thing as exercising for cardiovascular or health of the heart, if you will. So let's look into that, shall we? This is Mayo Clinic Proceedings 2015, Effects of Running on Chronic Disease and Cardiovascular and All-Cause Mortality. Here's what they did. They looked at studies that had at least 500 runners and at least 5 years of follow-up, and then they analyzed major health consequences, and they analyze everything. I'm talking diabetes, osteoporosis, cancer, LDL, cholesterol, every surrogate marker you can imagine, they looked at it. But then they also looked at about 55,000 individuals with 13,000 runners from the Aerobic Center Longitudinal Study Database. This is a nearly 15-year follow-up, and this is assess the running on cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality. Those are two hard endpoints that we just can't get away from. So what did it show? It showed that if you went from non-running to running, and I'm talking running even less than 51 minutes per week, less than 51 minutes per week, talking less than 6 miles per week, less than 1 to 2 times per week, and at a speed of less than 6 miles an hour. This is not crazy. Less than 6 miles per hour, less than 6 miles per week, less than 51 minutes per week. 51 minutes, I mean, I'm no math major, but that's like, 7 minutes and 20 seconds of running a day? That's not very much. I think we can all do that. Those runners in that lowest quintile or quartile received full benefits from running with regard to reduction in cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality compared to those runners that were running significantly more. Those runners that were running more than 176 minutes per week, running at a speed of greater than 7.6 miles per hour, and running, get this, more than 20 miles per hour. Less than 6 miles an hour, over 20 miles an hour. They were getting the same cardiovascular and all-cause mortality benefit. And when you look at the curve, it is absolutely astonishing. But I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. You're saying, listen here. I ain't got time for that. Can't do it. That's still, you know, 7 some minutes a day. I got to get the kids to daycare. I got to get groceries. I got to do some laundry. I got to make dinner. I got to pick up the kid. I can't do it. Cannot do it. Well, let's look at something a little simpler. Here we go. 12 weeks of sprint interval training improves the indices of cardiometabolic health, similar to the traditional 5-fold lower exercise volume commitment. Here we go. 2016, just kind of recently. They broke up individuals into three groups, and here's what the three groups were. Group one, you were in the sprint interval training. You did 20 seconds of all-out sprints three times. That's a total of 1 minute of exercise. You were in group two, that's moderate intensity continuous training. Involved 45 minutes of continuous cycling at 70% of maximum heart rate. And then there were the non-training controls, which just totally remained inactive as they were at baseline. They did it for 12 weeks. On total, that's 2.5. They followed up 2.5 times a week. So remember what I said earlier. That's a total of 1 minute of exercise, 2.5 times a week in the sprint group. After 12 weeks, they did a VO2 peak test to check on your oxygen consumption. They did body composition, muscle biopsies, glucose tolerance test. And in the end, between those that were working out for 45 minutes, 2.5 times a week, and those that were working out for 1 minute, 2.5 times a week, there was no difference. In fact, it's so unbelievable, I'm literally just going to quote right from them. 12 weeks of sprint interval training in previously inactive men improved insulin sensitivity, cardiorespiratory fitness, and skeletal muscle mitochondrial content to the same extent as moderate intensity continuous training, despite a five-fold lower exercise volume and training time commitment. So in the end, it's the 1 minute time challenge. It's 1 minute sprint all out, 1 minute, 2.5 times a week to get the same benefit as 45 minutes, 2.5 times a week. That is something. Now, I wish we had that trial for longer so we could see, is there the full mortality that benefit that we want? But if you can't do the 7 minutes, if you can't do the 7 minutes and 20 seconds, if that just is not doing it for you, 1 minute, 2.5 times a week, I think we can all do that. We can all squeeze that in somewhere in our busy life. So here's the bottom line. There is harm in working out. In fact, there is definitely harm. It's arrhythmia, but it is likely at a training level that you are not even close to, and the overall risk is still very small. The benefit of working out, even just a little, like a really little, like within, you know, seconds little, has huge upside on the cardiovascular health. And the correct exercise time length is somewhere between 2.5 minutes a week and around 2,000 hours of total endurance training. And that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that wraps it up. That concludes it. That takes it all off. 27 minutes. This is a long one. I don't even know how to condense it down any further. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, until I am back, which I promise will be definitely sooner than it has been this last time, keep the quest in questioning.